From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, June the 10th, 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you this morning. First-time visitor with the Dave Graham Show will be leading off. His name is Colin Flanders. He's a young reporter with 7 Days, and he is actually this week in today's paper, the one that's due out today, going to be covering a topic which I've wanted to delve into recently, and I said, 7 Days is doing it. I'll lean on them for all the info I need. And that is discussion about the northern border, the Vermont-Quebec border. What is happening up there? When are we going to get it back open again so people can start traveling back and forth between the two very friendly countries normally, et cetera. So we'll be talking with Colin Flanders about that in just a couple minutes after I tell you what else is coming up later in the show. And those include T.J. Donovan will be joining us in the second half hour this morning. He, of course, is running for re-election as Attorney General, and he will talk to us about what he feels he's accomplished so far during his time in office and what he hopes to accomplish, I believe, in his next term. And since he is one of the leading law enforcement personnel in Vermont, we're going to have to talk with him about all the discussions recently related to police violence and the response thereto and what needs to happen, et cetera, and how some of those issues may be playing out in Vermont. So we'll hear from the Attorney General in the second half hour. Later on, I wanted to do something that just a little more fun. Occasionally, I have to break away from the coronavirus and the unrest over police violence and all the other serious topics we've been talking about a lot lately here on the Dave Graham Show. And in the later hour of the program this morning, we're going to be talking to some folks who are doing a lot of baking with sourdough, baking bread. We're going to be speaking with Martin Phillip of King Arthur Flour. We have Blair Marvin from Elmore Mountain Bread, and a young baker who's just up and coming and really excited about it. Dan Rome from up in the Burlington area is going to be joining us as well. So I think the three of them will get into a good conversation, maybe get a rise out of some people. But let's get right into it. First off, with Colin Flanders, a new visitor to the Dave Graham Show. I'm so glad to be expanding our pool of journalists here. We can talk to occasionally. We had another first time journalist on the program, I believe, just yesterday, Tom Carney from the Story Reporter, who I thought provided a lot of good insights and thoughts. So let's let Colin Flanders lead off this morning. Colin, thanks very much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, dude.
So you are, and I got to say, we have sort of a new arrangement with 7 Days, which I think is going to work out great. I hope you guys are liking it as well as I am. But on Wednesday mornings, we're trying to feature one of your writers there who can talk about a story that is coming out in the paper that day. You guys are all past deadline and getting ready to have the paper roll out to the streets of Vermont, I think it's good promotion for you guys, and it helps us stay ahead of the news a little bit by maybe a couple hours here on the Dave Graham Show. We appreciate the opportunity, so I hope we can build on this budding partnership. Anyway, Colin, you have a story, I'm told, in today's paper relating to the northern border, and tell us about it.
Yeah, so I think we were really interested in how the virus has impacted our ability and our relationship with our northern neighbors. It's no secret that Vermont has very close ties to Canada, and both represent a pretty sizable portion of our tourism economy. And so I took a look this week at how the border closure has been impacting both people on a personal level, but also on an economic level, taking a look at some businesses up in the North Hero area. And so dating back to mid-March, that both the U.S. and Canada decided to close their border to only non-essential travel. So that's things like food, medicine. Actually, 7 Days is printed in Quebec and shipped down. Thankfully, that's an essential good these days. But other things like just normal travel, people want to go on vacation or even visit family up until recently has not been allowed. So we took a look at how that was impacted. I spoke to one woman who has spent the last 3 months up in Quebec because she has a long-term partner up there. And if she came back down across the border anytime during the last 3 months, she would be unable to see him until the border opened back up. So it's personal stories like that. And people often, some people live up around the border, even cross over to do grocery trips, basic things like that. It's had a pretty wide-ranging impact.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, and I know Vermont is, I believe I've seen a figure at some point in the past that the state is about one-third French-Canadian heritage, actually, you know, just in our demographic makeup here. And I think, of course, that very prevalent in places like Maine and New Hampshire as well. Mm-hmm. And with the northern border closed, that's got to really have had a big impact on quite a number of families, you know, just in terms of people. I would think this time of year, in the springtime, maybe, you know, you weren't traveling as much in the winter, maybe since the holidays or whatever, but spring comes and you want to get together with your cousins or your grandparents or whoever it is who might still be on the other side of the border, and all of a sudden that stuff's not happening, huh?
Yeah, yeah, and we did just recently have some movement on that. So on Monday, the Canadian Prime Minister moved to allow families to be reconnected. So if you have an immediate family member, you can cross the border to visit them. But other than that, it's so in the case that I was talking about, they're not married. They're not going to be allowed to cross the border still. I also interviewed a few people who didn't make it into the story who have family down here who won't be able to visit them. It's pretty tough. And you're right, especially this time of year when weather starts getting nicer, people start getting together. There's Memorial Day gatherings, July 4th gatherings. It's a time where we really do spend a lot of time with our family, and it has impacted a lot of people who live up in that area. Yeah.
And that's kind of amazing, because I think, my impression is that as you get closer to the border, there are even, you know, there's a higher prevalence of families with you know, close kin on the other side of the border. You know, I know there are parts of northern Vermont where a lot of French is still spoken, for instance, and that just tells you a lot about the culture and the traditional, you know, intermingling across the border, et cetera. And you're right. I mean, there are communities in along the border where people, I think, have traditionally relied for services, you know, maybe even go to see a doctor or go to see, I don't know, you know, get their cars worked on or whatever. I mean, and this could be Canadians coming, you know, people who live in Quebec coming into Vermont or vice versa. All of that's been shut down, huh?
Yeah, yep. And then there's the whole economic side, which I think is probably no secret to a lot of people, but Canadian tourists typically represent about $150 million in spending on any given year. Somewhere between 600,000 and 700,000 Canadians visit Vermont annually during normal times. And so for a lot of these tourism-dependent businesses that are starting to gradually reopen right now and are hoping that sort of this pent-up energy in the economy might help spur them towards recovery a little faster, they're worried. I've talked to a few people in North Hero. They know the longer the border closure extends, it means less tourists, it means less second homeowners who have a pretty big presence in the Champlain Islands. And each week that goes by, they're sort of sitting there waiting, because these are the prime months. I mean, I talked to one shop owner who said he'll make as much in the summer in 1 week, or in 1 day rather, that he'll make in his sort of best day in the winter. I mean, it's a pretty brutal time, and a lot of them can't really do much but wait and see how it plays out.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, are you hearing that further restrictions, or there might be a further lifting of restrictions? Is there any calendar or any estimate of you know, for instance, you mentioned this couple, unmarried couple, I guess, who normally would be traveling back and forth to see one another, not been happening lately. When are they going to be able to get back together?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the border closure has been extended multiple times. Right now it's supposed to expire June 21st. We're getting mixed signals from the leaders of the two countries. President Trump has said that he wants the border to be one of the first things reopened. He has said that he thinks both countries are doing great with the virus, and I think it's a recognition of the tourism impact. The problem is, on the other side of the border, Justin Trudeau has sort of cautioned that it may take some more time, and I think a lot of people on both sides of the border are wary, as we're both still fighting outbreaks of the virus, and we're not sure if a second wave of the pandemic is going to come later this year. So I think there's a lot of people are wary of opening up too quickly. So as for the couple right now, I think they're waiting and seeing how it goes. If it gets extended again into July, I think they're going to have a pretty tough decision on their hands. Because the woman I spoke with, she, as you alluded to, this is when she spends a lot of time with her family. She has an 84-year-old mother who lives in upstate New York she hasn't been able to see. And so she's sort of feeling torn on what to do. So they're keeping a close eye on it and hoping that maybe it gets extended or it doesn't get extended. I think the issue from there is that now that it's happened, a lot of people feel that it won't be too hard to reinstate it, which can be difficult if you don't have certainty, especially as a business owner or even as a family member. If you don't know if you cross the border, then when the next time you'll be able to get back up there, it might influence the way you handle the situation.
Yeah, that is tough. I mean, and I gotta say, it's not just it isn't just cross border situations, but I know people here in Vermont who, you know, have family members who are, say, in nursing homes or assisted living, you know, other institutional settings, and they haven't been allowed to visit because those places are not. I think that's still the case, isn't it? Isn't it still the case that you're not able to go into those places yet?
Yep, you're right. And the governor said that's probably going to be one of the last things that we reopen, sort of in recognition of the vulnerability there. But you're totally right. It's not just the border. It's not even just Canada. I have family in New York. I haven't been able to see them for a few months because I know if up until now, if I left and came back, I'd have to quarantine. And that's true for a lot of people.
Yeah, we're the same way. My wife's from New Hampshire, and her mom's in an assisted living over in Concord. We haven't seen her since early winter, you know. So it's the same sort of situation. I think very widespread, but it's something about the having that international border also is an extra thing because you know the differences in the response to the coronavirus that you're inevitably going to be between the two countries and so on. Talk to me a little bit about how the response in Canada compares to that here. I mean, are they more restrictive up there, a little less restrictive? You know, who's turning the what Phil Scott calls the spigot more quickly? I guess question.
So I didn't get into that too much in the story. I'm not exactly sure how their responses compared to ours. One thing that I did touch on with my source who lives up there is they are taking their quarantine pretty strictly. They sort of follow up on it, whereas here in Vermont, it's a lot more of a trust factor. So for her, if she came back into Vermont, and if, say, the border closure does end, she comes back into Vermont, and then she's able to get back up there, she knows that she's going to have to quarantine for another 14 days, and they'll just be sort of creating house arrest if they keep bouncing back and forth across the border. I do know that they are taking a very cautious approach, and I think we're hearing different things from the leaders of the two countries. President Trump is pushing to open up, and I think Justin Trudeau is pumping the brakes a little bit and telling people that it's going to take some time. And so I think we should expect, even if the border does open up, that some of these quarantine requirements will stay in place. And the governor has said much of the same, especially as outbreaks still are ongoing and within close proximity.
Do you know what any of the data are showing for Canada? I mean, it's interesting. Then you have to say, okay, so really there are two different approaches here with President Trump trying to push for a quicker opening in the United States, but of course, then we're seeing reports this week of lots of increase instances of coronavirus in a lot of places around the country. I think 21 states I saw are reporting increases. And I'm wondering, is Canada doing better from a public health perspective? I mean, maybe the U.S. is doing better from an economic perspective, but I mean, I'm just
Well, I think for the U.S., I mean, we have the most coronavirus cases across the world, and I think per capita it's a little bit of a different picture, but it's just the sheer numbers can sort of scare people. And I think that in Montreal they were fighting a pretty sizable outbreak, and the woman that I spoke with up there, who lives about an hour east of Montreal, said that it's died down a little bit, but I think everybody just knows that it doesn't take long for it to sprout back up, as we're seeing here in Chittenden County with the recent outbreak. I mean, I think there's a recognition that even as the numbers start getting lower, opening up something like the border to a lot of travel, it could lead to a lot of new arrivals who are coming from places that it's hard to keep track of. I mean, I think, I don't have too much info on the exact numbers of the Canadian outbreak there, I'll be honest.
Right. Okay. In terms of the overall border picture, have you sort of looked much at you know, a little farther east in Vermont, over toward Newport or Derby Line? Those Derby Line, of course, big border crossing, because that's right at the northern end and terminus in the U.S. of I-91. Any sense of what's happening over in that neighborhood?
Yeah, so I mean, across the board, crossings are down dramatically. I think the most recent federal data is from April 2020, and it shows that personal vehicle traffic is down almost 90%. And so the people who are still crossing are the mostly essential workers, people like healthcare workers or airline workers. But Derby Line, for example, if on a typical April, so April 2019, there were around 57,000 personal vehicle passengers, and that dropped to a little over 1,000 this past April.
Wow.
And so, just the numbers go to show that these are a lot of people who come into Vermont and will spend money on hotels or restaurants. They will shop at the stores. I mean, this is a lot of money that is getting trapped across the border. And as you said, a lot of personal ties. So it's a pretty tough time for everyone.
I know somebody up in the Kingdom who had a kid recently graduated from high school, but had actually attended school in just across the border in Stansted. They call it a college up there, even though we would think of it as a high school. I don't remember the actual name of the college, but I think I've understood that there are a number of young people in Vermont who were going to school up that way. Of course, I guess schools are all shut down in Vermont. Is that the case in Quebec too? Do we know? And maybe this isn't even really any extra issue with the border here, but I mean, that's another aspect of that personal international travel that occurs, where there is some there are people who are normally going back and forth to go to high school or university. You know, people from Vermont going up to Montreal to go to McGill or Concordia or one of those schools.
Yeah, you're totally right, and vice versa. I mean, a lot of Canadian students come down to attend colleges like UVM. I did check in with UVM to see how they're handling this, and from the sounds of it, students are still allowed to cross the border if they're attending an educational institution. But like you said, a lot of these schools aren't having summer classes, and so it won't be until fall where we really see the impact of that. And at that point, the closure might be lifted. So I think a lot of people are in the wait-and-see approach.
In the wait-and-see approach, it's it really is kind of a just a strange, I don't know, almost feels like Hiatus is one word that pops into my head. I'm not sure exactly. I mean, we're kind of so much about this is sort of makes us feel, I think, kind of frozen in place or something. I don't know exactly how to describe it, but maybe some listeners could help. Hey, listeners, if you have any comments or questions you'd like to put about the border to Colin Flanders of 7 days, you're more than welcome to give us a call in these last few minutes of this segment. We have open phone lines here, of course. 244-1777 is a local number in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK. And Colin, I'm just wondering your sort of coverage area at the at 7 days these days. What are your beats? Are you normally covering economics and that kind of stuff, or is it just all general assignment and everything?
Yeah, well, I joke that my job here changes every few months. I started. I'm a political reporter, and I work at the State House mostly. So I started in late October, got a few months under my belt, then moved up to the State House, and then that shut down. And I'm sort of waiting on my next assignment here. But I think a lot of our jobs have changed across the board, and this is true of any newspaper right now. I think we're trying to adapt to the current situation. So I cover some of the legislature. I've been following higher education, and then whatever else our editors throw at us.
Yeah, boy, higher education. Actually, in these last few minutes, maybe you could just give us a quick briefing on latest news on the Vermont State Colleges, because it looks like some things might be moving even in the legislature that on that front.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the legislature is still continuing to look at a temporary bailout, if you want to call it that, that will help the state college system get through the next year. There has been some recent reports put out from the Joint Fiscal Office and the Treasurer's Office looking at sort of doing an audit of the finances to figure out exactly how much money will be needed. Looks like somewhere in the ballpark of $15 to $25 million, as we've been hearing. And so I think there's been no firm decision yet. I think it's still a lot is in the motion, but it does seem like the legislature is very committed to getting them through the next year. And internally, the state college system is working to, as they're saying, re-envision what the what it's going to look like in years to come. And so while they're also going through a search for a new interim chancellor and looking for a college president, I mean, it's a pretty busy time over there. But a lot of colleges in general, I mean, UVM has announced some recent pay cuts. As we talk about the wait-and-see approach, I think a lot of them are concerned about what the fall is going to look like. And for the Vermont State College system, that is on top of all the other strifes that they're going through. It's a pretty challenging time.
Yeah, it really is. And I wonder if the, you know, sort of what the future shape of these institutions will be. I mean, will, you know, Jeb Spaulding, of course, had that bombshell proposal a couple of months back and ended up leaving afterward, talking about closing down three of the campuses. Are we going to end up having some facsimile thereof, or are we going to end up with one or two campuses closing, or is there any way to read the tea leaves as yet, Colin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little too early to say exactly what it's going to look like, but those tough conversations are ongoing, and I think there is a recognition that, as former Chancellor Spaulding said, the current configuration is not working. And so I don't know if that means that they'll close a campus. It could be trimming back on some things or moving things around. I mean, it seems like they're keeping the door open, but I think everybody does recognize that they can't just continue on exactly as they are. And I think they're hoping over the coming months that they'll be able to figure that out a little clearer. And if it does come down to making a tough decision, at least giving people a little more time to stomach it. I think that was one of the biggest concerns with Chancellor Spaulding's proposal, is that there just wasn't a lot of time to take it in. But the problem's out there, and I think a lot of people recognize that.
Yeah, that is, you know, it's clearly sort of one of these works in progress that people can't drop the ball. They really have to And my sense is that the administrators and folks at the state colleges have not dropped the ball. They're really still in the mix, but I'm thinking mainly here of, you know, legislators, even members of the public who care about this stuff, need to be paying attention, because obviously there are a lot of tough decisions to be made as we roll forward into the future of the Vermont State Colleges. And UVM is the flagship school going to get open, looking anything like normal in the fall? Are we going to have sports? Are we going to have people back in the classrooms? What are you hearing there?
Yeah, I'm not sure on the sports front, but I mean, right before June 1st, the date where students sort of had to pick where they were going, or maybe it was actually in April, but UVM did announce that it's coming back for the fall, and I think all indications are that they're still moving ahead with that. I think there is a little skepticism of whether it will look anything like what a traditional fall looks like at UVM. And I think a lot remains to be seen of whether a second wave of the pandemic comes. But I think that there is, across the board of higher education, there is a reconfiguration of what we consider a traditional in the classroom experience. But I know they're wary because there's a group of students, as you probably know, that are suing the school to try to get some tuition money back, and that's millions of dollars. So they're trying to walk this fine line between encouraging enough students to come so their financials aren't dipping too low, but also they have to be, I guess, wary of overpromising because as the reason shows.
Hey, Colin, we are about out of time on this segment of the Dave Graham Show, but I really appreciate you, Colin Flanders of 7 Days, joining me this morning. Lots of good information and insights. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Alrighty, we're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors, and T.J. Donovan, the Attorney General, will be joining us in the second half hour. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us, folks. We're going to be talking during this half hour on the Dave Graham Show with T.J. Donovan, the Attorney General of the state of Vermont, and he is seeking a new term in office as of this November, running for re-election, another 2-year term, that is, for the Attorney General, and we expect he'll be checking in with us shortly. We had a phone call scheduled right around now with the Attorney General, so we'll hope to hear from him very shortly. And when the we're trying to actually organize a sort of meet the candidates series here, informal, you know, not a set day of the week, but generally and a lot of times it is this second half hour of the program when we like to get the candidates on for a little bit to just tell us you know, what they've been doing, if they're already in office, what they hope to continue to do or do something new in their next term. And and obviously with Mr. Donovan as one of the chief, if not the chief, law enforcement officers in the state of Vermont, that is a big part of what the Attorney General does. In fact, the Attorney General oversees cases of alleged police misconduct and investigates them and can prosecute them and so on. So he really has a key role in the way Vermont regulates its police personnel and police departments. And so we're going to have to check in with him some just to find out what his thoughts are on all of this national discussion about changing the way we do police in the United States and obviously trying to correct some of the real racial inequities in the way policing has been conducted in the United States. Vermont is not completely immune from this stuff. I've mentioned the other day, back in, I think it was 2016, I wrote a story when I was still working as a reporter for the Associated Press, in which the state police came up with some data indicating that If you were African-American in Vermont and out driving on our roads and you were pulled over by a police officer, you were five times as likely, roughly, as a white driver to have your car searched. And that disparity right there seems to really make some people sit up and take notice and start to think about trying to reduce the amount of bias in policing. And there was a lot of discussion, still is today, about the difference between what the experts call implicit bias and explicit bias. And explicit bias is really overt statements and obvious cases of racism, that kind of thing. Implicit bias, though, is maybe even harder to root out, because sometimes people just sort of have what they think is background knowledge or background feelings about members of other races or ethnic groups, and they don't really completely come out and acknowledge what those thoughts or feelings or claims of knowledge are, and yet they do. Those interior thoughts can influence the way a person goes about his or her work. So interested in sort of finding out more about, I think, over time, how police agencies in particular are dealing with this stuff. Obviously, these are issues throughout our society. Racism is not unique to police and police departments. So I think we can see that in many, many instances around the country. Just in recent weeks, of course, we had that terrible shooting death of a black jogger in Georgia by a couple of guys, a father and son, who were not police officers. They were just, sort of vigilante types or something. Saw this man jogging in the neighborhood, thought he was up to no good just because he was jogging, and jogging while black, maybe. That kind of thing, or this really weird case in Central Park in New York a couple weeks ago, where this a white woman and a black man who's the man who's out doing bird watching. He actually is a member of this guy, Christian Cooper, a member of the New York Audubon Society board. So very serious bird enthusiast, from what we read. And he was out doing his birding in an area called the Ramble, and got into this dispute with a white dog walker, and she basically threatened to call the police. He wanted her to put her dog on a leash, which is required in that part of Central Park. She threatened to call the police and bring down the power of the police on this guy for basically asking her to obey the law and put her dog on her leash. So, holy Moses. Anyway, I think we do have TJ Donovan now joining us this morning on the phone. Mr. Attorney General, I appreciate you doing so. Good morning.
Dave, thanks for having me. Good morning to you.
And so you are running for, I think it's going to be your third term, is that right?
That is correct. Running for my third term as Attorney General. And yep. It's the first to have gone my way.
Yeah, I guess time flies when you are in public life in Vermont. Or time flies anyway. At least for me, I'm getting older now, and my brother told me a while back that as you get older, every passing week or year or whatever the interval is a smaller fraction of your life. So they seem to speed up. I don't know.
That is
an optimistic. Thank you. Yeah. Anyway. Tell me a little bit about your case. The case for reelecting T.J. Donovan. We were trying to bring in all the candidates and just kind of get people to expound on why they should be the office holder. And so tell us why Vermonters should give you another term as Attorney General.
I'm running for Attorney General to continue to represent and fight for all Vermonters.
I think we are having a little bit of a cell phone issue with you, TJ. Is there a way to get to a better spot and maybe call us back, or we're not getting the best reception?
Can you hear me now?
That's a little better. Want to try that?
Okay. Yeah, okay. I guess I'll stand in this spot, Dave.
Okay.
okay. You know, I'm running to stand up and to fight and protect all Vermonters. Again, as I said, whether it's the consumer out there during this time of COVID-19 who are worried about the economic anxiety that this virus has spread among all of us, to make sure people are getting a fair deal, continuing to work on reforming our criminal justice system, which includes reforms to how we police, to address the issues of racism, to address the issues of discrimination, to address the issues of use of force, standing up and protecting our environment. I think it's a basic human right that people should be able to drink clean water and breathe clean air, to continue to protect all Vermonters' civil rights, and to stand up against the Trump administration in Washington, D.C. When the federal government steps back, Vermont will step up and protect people. That's what I've done these first two terms. This is what I continue to do, and this is why I'm seeking another term as Vermont's Attorney General.
And what do you see as the sort of coming big issues? Imagine, let's roll the clock forward, a crystal ball or whatever. 2021 will be, we hope, emerging by then from this coronavirus pandemic. And obviously the state will be having some real budget issues, I would think, from all of the current economic shocks still rippling through the system, so to speak. And I'm just wondering, are we, what do you see as the top two or three kind of agenda items that might be unique to 2021, your next sort of first year in office?
Sure. I think right now what the focus is on, rightfully so, is continuing to reform how we police, to build back that public trust in law enforcement. Right now, obviously, what's gone on with the George Floyd murder, to address the issues of systemic racism that exists in our state, and to make Vermont a more fair, more equal, more diverse state for all of us. Number two, the economic anxiety that is everybody is feeling as a result of this pandemic. I am concerned about what's going to happen in the fall. We've had a lot of good programs that have deferred payments. Those payments don't go away, Dave. Those bills will come due at some point in time. How do we protect Vermonters from this new economic reality? How do we address, how do we create jobs in, again, the 21st century that is changing dramatically? How do we attract and retain people to come to this state, particularly our young people, to come and stay at this state, to make higher education not only affordable but accessible in what appears to be a new normal of remote learning? So those are some of the issues, of course, that I think we'll be dealing with as we go forward as a result of what's happening today in our state, in our country. Obviously, environmental protection, addressing climate change remains a priority. And I'll be blunt with you, Dave. I hope in January of 2021, on January 20th, we're swearing in a new president of the United States.
And I'm wondering, let's sort of break these down individually. I guess one is the law enforcement issue. Obviously, is top of mind for so many people right now. Are there any specific reforms that you think need to happen in Vermont, or more progress to be made on already existing sort of reform efforts out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to change the use of force standard in our state. And as a prosecutor who is charged with reviewing use of force incidents, is oftentimes a lethal force, we need to change from what we would call a reasonableness standard to a necessary standard. That is the standard that California has adopted. It won't be easy. There's a current bill in the legislature, 808, that proposes that. I support that. We need to bring all the stakeholders together and work towards that. We need to make, and that will limit the use of force, to make force not only reasonable, but necessary and proportional, and really make force the last resort, to continue to train and modernize on the issues of de-escalation, on cultural competency, here's the bottom line, Dave. You know, we got 70-plus law enforcement agencies in the state of Vermont, and policing's a hard job. And when they all go to the academy, they get trained on use of force. But when they go into their respective departments, the 70-plus departments, every department, there's no uniformity or standard use of force policy. And it's absurd that a use of force policy up in Derby could be different than the one down in Bennington. And so let's standardize and normalize and have the best practice in terms of use of force that makes it the last option only when it's necessary and not just when it's reasonable based on the circumstances, to continue to invest in restorative justice, to continue to invest in alternative justice systems that are community-based and are public health. And in terms of the policing, look, let's ban these strangleholds and chokeholds. We don't need them. We don't need them. They're dangerous. We saw that. Let's also make sure when we're talking about policing in Vermont, when there are bad actors, and look, the police have a tough job, but like any organization, we're going to have some bad actors. And when there is those excessive use of force complaints and findings, let's make sure that those are widely shared, so one officer who is fired from one department doesn't travel 30 miles up the road to another department and get hired.
I'm wondering if you think that there should be additional layers of civilian review. Certainly they've wrestled with this some in Burlington. Should there be more accountability along those lines for police departments around Vermont?
Yes. Every department should have a civilian oversight committee that actually has teeth. Because, Dave, at the end of the day, the police derive their power from the people of this state. And the police represent the people of this state. There should be civilian oversight.
And those civilian oversight, I mean, should they have the authority actually to really do enforcement along the lines of, you know, dismissing or firing an officer who is found to have committed some kind of misconduct?
Well, I think what we should do is look around this country where we have those civilian oversight panels empowered and look at what works, look at what doesn't work, again, figure out what the best practice is and implement. You know, other jurisdictions have dealt with some of these reforms. Let's look at what works and let's bring it to Vermont.
In terms of the sort of heightened climate of protest and of activism, et cetera, in the past couple of weeks around the country, including here in Vermont, I mean, we had this huge demonstration in Montpelier, about 5,000 people, the law enforcement folks said, turned out on Sunday for what turned out to be a very peaceful protest. We've had, obviously, lots of different outpourings in Burlington, all over the state, really. I mean, Morrisville on Sunday, I had a big procession of cars come through the center of town as an act of protest. And so really lots of this stuff going on. And meanwhile, I've been seeing a lot of chatter online in which there are typically posters, you know, online people who lean left are pointing up that we all should be worried about the growth of right-wing groups, even neo-Nazi groups, getting a toehold in Vermont. Meanwhile, some of our conservative, right-leaning media in Vermont last week there was a story about supposedly Antifa being active in towns or the state police in Massachusetts watching for Antifa along the Vermont border. Have you seen any evidence of either of these kinds of things emerging? And if so, which one is more worrisome to you?
Well, I think when we talk about the folks who are out there protesting right now, the vast majority of those folks are good people, are decent people, and needed a outlet to express their outrage and anger under their First Amendment rights to peaceably assemble and to protest. And so I fully support that. And I put out a statement with Governor Scott saying we support the protesters and for the police to exercise restraint during these protests and give people the space, give them the opportunity to express their outrage. I certainly did not like the images that I saw in other cities where the police were going in when they had imposed a curfew and were using force and violence to break up peaceful demonstrations. I did not like that at all, and I'm glad that in Vermont we do things differently. We did it peacefully, so I want to thank the protesters, and I want to thank the police for exercising the restraint and engaging in a collaborative relationship with the protesters to make sure that these protests went off peacefully. Now, in regards to whether, as you say, far right or far left groups, look, I'm sure they're in Vermont. They're everywhere. And what we have to do is be vigilant, continue to do our job as law enforcement, to continue to investigate these incidences as they arise, and go by the facts, go by the evidence, and go by the law. And that's what we're going to do.
And do you have any sense of, is there a toehold in Vermont being gained? You say they're everywhere, but I mean, what's bigger, sort of neo-Nazi style groups right now, or these folks who are, and I'm not even sure you could define it, Antifa as a group. I mean, I've read some articles saying it's really more of just kind of a collection of political ideologies or positions or whatever, but much less organized than some of the militia groups and others on the right. So what do you see out there? I mean, is there any evidence of this happening on either end of the spectrum in Vermont? And so I'll stop there.
Yeah,
that's my question.
Well, I don't think. Look, I don't want to speculate, and certainly speculate publicly about information in terms of what's happening in Vermont. I think what we've seen in other jurisdictions is evidence of this. Look, at the end of the day, we're certainly going to protect people's First Amendment rights, but we're not going to allow people to engage in violence, and we're not going to allow people to engage in threatening behavior, and we're not going to allow people to destroy other people's property. That's not protected under the First Amendment. And so, again, what I would say is that we continue to monitor the situation, not only in Vermont, but nationally. I certainly am in contact with many of my colleagues across our country, and will continue to remain vigilant and make sure that people are protected in Vermont.
We have a caller on the line. I think Paul from Moncton joins us. Paul, good morning.
Dave, good morning, TJ.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hey,
what's on your mind, Paul?
I'm sorry, this subject that I'm going to bring up is not as weighty as what you were just talking about. I apologize, but it's something that's been in the back of my mind for a while. And that is, last year, the Department of Liquor Control was authorized to start and mandate that stores start selling gift cards. Gift cards that were actually mandated they had to sell to people even under age. And one of the reasons, or a couple of reasons that they were told to do so, were because of a decision made in your office, TJ, that gift cards could not be sold to people and discriminated against based upon age. But the other one issue that came up was that they determined that the gift card itself is not actually alcohol, so therefore is not regulated like you would actually a bottle of hard alcohol. The problem I have with that, and I'm confused about, is at the same time your office came down with those rules, the stores are selling can't sell tobacco to underage people, and they also can't sell rolling papers, pipes, and even, I believe, cigarette lighters, which aren't actually tobacco. So why is it you can't sell one that is not tobacco, but you can sell the other that isn't alcohol? It seems to me it's a contradiction you guys need to resolve, because you can't have it one way, different ways for different products. I hope that's not too confusing.
TJ, did you get all that?
A little bit. I think we had this question, and I just don't have the answer off the top of my head. I'm vaguely familiar with this question, but I don't have the answer off the top of my head. I don't want to misspeak, Dave, but what I would say to Paul is, give us a call at 283-171, and we're happy to, if we, gave guidance to The Vermont Department of Liquor were happy to share that guidance with Paul and explain the reasoning behind it. So just give us a call, Paul, and happy to explain it. Look, at the end of the day, we may agree to disagree, but we're happy to talk with you.
Okay.
Okay, let's go to thanks for the call, Paul. Let's go to Jim Waitsfield. Good morning, Jim.
Am I on? How are you?
Yes. How are you doing?
So this is a little off-topic subject, but with the governor's guidances on restaurants and businesses, restaurants are hurting. So I was on the Board of Adjustment in Waitsfield for a number of years, and routinely when restaurants were getting permitted or things, we would put a limit, of say 100, you can have 100 capacity based on parking, septic, based on all kinds of different things. So that was sort of a rule of law that, so I assume things like that get put into leases. So you've got a restaurant, you're leasing a restaurant that can hold 100. Is it within the Attorney General's power to give a legal, legal opinion on whether or not the governor, the COVID guidances can affect leases, which would give restaurants and stuff a lot more room to renegotiate leases. For example, if you signed a lease that says, I'm signing a lease for 100 seat restaurant or whatever, based on the Board of Adjustment, the fire codes, the septic, the whatever. And now you can't. Is it within your? Do you think that that's something that you could do to do a legal opinion on whether or not people had the? I won't say right, but had the. Had the room to renegotiate based on what the government is doing at this point.
TJ, any thoughts?
Yeah, right now our job is to defend and to enforce the governor's executive order. And in fact, we're involved in litigation regarding the governor's executive order down in Rutland County. We had sued a gym owner who allegedly violated the order. He then countersued, naming both myself and the governor. And so our position in the Attorney General's office is to defend the governor's order, and our position is that it is not only constitutional but lawful.
Okay. Well, we are fast approaching the top of the hour here, meaning we are about running out of time here on the Dave Graham Show on this segment of T.J. Donovan, the Attorney General of Vermont. I very much appreciate you joining me this morning and being willing to take a variety of questions here. And I suspect we may be chatting as the campaign goes on. And I thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Sorry about the connection.
That's okay. All right, we are going to go to a top-of-the-hour break from CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors. Elena Treen from Axios will be joining us just after the top of the hour. And then later on, we're going to talk about the boom in sourdough bread baking. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into the second hour of our program on this Wednesday, June the 10th, 2020. And I'm happy to say we are joined once again by a reporter for Axios, terrific online national news service, and Elena Treen is, I believe, with me on the phone. Good morning, Elena.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having
so,
me on.
So, yeah, we are, of course, continuing to cover, as you are, and basically all the media, all of the ramifications coming from this horrible incident May 25th in Minneapolis, the killing by police officers of George Floyd. And we have the memorial service yesterday. Tell us a little bit about what Axios is highlighting here as the sort of follow-up coverage continues.
So we've been covering, you know, we've covered the George Floyd's funeral. We've been watching closely on the Hill what lawmakers are proposing and the reform packages that they're, you know, working with on the Hill, but also with President Trump on. And then also our CEO of Axios, Jim Vandehei, kind of wrote an open letter to CEOs in our Axios AM newsletter today, just explaining how the world's changing, laws are being changed to meet this moment, and that businesses and companies need to rise to the occasion as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. What do you think is the general mood or any specific reforms? We'll get to the reforms proposed on Capitol Hill in a moment, but in terms of American businesses, what are they? Is there anything sort of gelling and coalescing there?
Yes, well, I think, and as my colleague for our CEO, Jim Vandehei, had written, you know, it's really becoming this bottom-up movement where social media and reporters and others are bringing attention to companies and making them listen to their staffers' concern. And so he really talks about transparency being necessary now, not just, you know, a good thing, but a necessary thing, as well as, you know, really meeting the moment on diversity and inclusion efforts. And there's no way to duck those uncomfortable conversations anymore, and that it's really a time that businesses have to listen to their staff, listen to the needs of their employees, and rise to this occasion.
Yeah, it is a I think it's going to be quite a process, really. And I wanted to ask you, in terms of the critical mass, I think it used to be called, you know, back, that's kind of a term from the 60s, perhaps, which I think was originally borrowed from, you know, atomic or nuclear technology or whatever. But it seems as though we may be at a time. You think back to when the Ferguson, Michael Brown's, the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson 5 years ago, and you know, it seemed as though there was quite a bit of upset, of course, in the African-American community. Certainly that city was in the grip of unrest for some days after that. But you didn't have the sense, I don't think, of a real nationwide turning point or whatever that this... We seem to be seeing now, and I wonder if you agree with that, and if it's if you think that you know, this time it's for real, and that real changes might result.
And you can only hope that this time it's for real and changes will resolve. And I think that what we're seeing play out across the country, even the globe, and other, you know, nations joining in protests of George Floyd's, you know, death. I think it is a bit different. I mean, yes, we've seen things like this happen in the past, tragic events where Black people were killed at the hands of, you know, bad cops. And I think what's different about this time is, well, for one, you know, the world and our country is facing a pandemic right now that's keeping a lot of people at home, keeping a lot of people glued to their phones, to their television sets. And in the past, where, you know, some of these movements might have been bogged down by someone going to a birthday party or having, you know, other events in their lives, you know, take priority. Right now, everyone's at home and paying attention to this. So that's one thing that I think is a benefit to the timing of what has happened. But I also think that, you know, I think in America, you can only hope that social media is spreading this message quicker and educating more people, and that people are really seeing the need for change here. And it does seem like, unlike in the past, you know, everyone agrees that change is needed. And I know that lawmakers, Republican, Democrat alike, agree that something needs to be changed and are working with the White House on making those changes as well, which is an optimistic viewpoint of potentially having some real policy here as well that's changing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is my sense of it too. That you know, we are at this tipping point here, and I wonder whether we can't tie all of this to, you know, the Trump administration and President Trump, but I wonder. Obviously, there are some connections and overlaps here, which have some implications for the for the 2020 election. President Trump, of course, is, you know, has been taking basically a very strong kind of law and order stance and speaking out quite forcefully against a lot of the protests, and certainly calling for tough law enforcement against anybody who is breaking the law in the process of protests, et cetera. And I'm wondering, do you think that that is going to help him in this upcoming election, or is he out of step here?
So I think that some of what the president, his rhetoric on this, some of that does speak to his base. But I think if he needs to win re-election in the fall, of course, he needs to connect with voters outside of his base. And having spoken with people at the White House and some of his top aides, as well as people on his campaign, they're very concerned with how his response to this moment is playing in the polls and with voters. And we've seen in the past few weeks regarding the protests that his response has really not sat well with independents and women who don't like his tone on this. And it really could be a massive damaging factor to his reelection. Of course, we're still a few months out. It's unclear what this will look like come the fall and whether, you know, some of these feelings and emotions will drive people to stay home or vote for a different candidate. But I do know that it's a massive concern among his aides. And, you know, he's only continuing to fan some of those flames. He had a tweet yesterday that, you know, promoted a conspiracy that he saw on One American News Network about one of a 75-year-old man who was pushed in Buffalo, New York. Those were things that I know a lot of aides and Republicans on the Hill were saying was just absurd and damaging and confusing. And I think that's going to continue to be something that we see if he keeps the rhetoric that he has.
And this gentleman allegedly was part of something, this Antifa, that has been quite the bogeyman for the president and for some others. I mean, but my understanding from most of what I read is that there's not really even a formal group by that name. That this is more a matter of a set of political sentiments, isn't it? I mean, it tends to be left-leaning political sentiments, but there isn't really any organization here, is there?
No, that's exactly right, and it is why it's been pretty puzzling to a lot of people when the president said that he had directed his attorney general to label Antifa a terrorist organization, because it's not an organization. It's more so a set of beliefs, you know, or kind of a movement is how others have described it. And again, and I just want to be very clear that the allegations of the 75-year-old Buffalo protester being an Antifa provocateur, as the president called it, there's just no basis in fact or evidence for that. And so I think you have to be very clear that people have to be careful with what they're hearing on those things, because it's not true from everything that we know so far.
And the president made reference to, I didn't really get this, and maybe I'm not up on the technology or something, but the president made reference to this man scanning the police or something with his phone. Do you know what that even about? What is that allegation about?
So I believe that the allegation is that they were trying to tamper with police equipment. And again, I haven't looked as far into it, so I'm not sure if that's something that other protesters or people had been doing. But again, no evidence or facts that this man in particular had been doing that. So a lot of, you know, a lot of news flying around, and some of it, of course, getting picked up by the president himself, that you have to have a dose of skepticism when viewing.
Yeah, that is probably a good thought strategy, a dose of skepticism for sure. Because, I mean, I guess the other thing that bothered me about the president's remarks on this incident in Buffalo, a lot of protesters, and I did read where this gentleman had been involved in protest movements and so on for a number of years in the Buffalo area. And I think in the town where I live, Montpelier, Vermont, there, I know folks here who, some of them are getting pretty elderly now, who have been basically protesting since the Vietnam War, and every time there's a little peace gathering or something, they head out and they hold the signs and it's just sort of, and you kind of say that's their First Amendment, right? What's the big danger here? I don't get why anybody should be, considering this guy to be, I don't know, part of a potential terrorist group because he has had, sentiments which are not real friendly to militarism and so on over the years. I mean, is that really what we're talking about here?
Right. And I think it really was just a remarkable moment and a remarkable tweet. And, of course, a big thing in political circles and among political reporters like myself was trying to see what Republicans on the Hill had thought about this. Of course, they had the classic, I haven't read it, or I won't comment on that, I haven't seen it yet, even though reporters had said they printed it out, a dodging mechanism, really, because I think that Republicans didn't really want to address it, like they don't with other inflammatory tweets from the president. But privately, Senate aides, Senate lawmakers, as well as some of the president's own aides have all kind of said that it probably wasn't the right thing for the president to tweet or to share. And so that's kind of the consensus from at least the folks that I've been speaking with.
Yeah. Oh, well, the beat goes on. Elena Treen of Axios, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you.
To you as well. Thank you.
I wanted to do something with the remainder of the show today, which I thought would be just a sort of an interesting and fun topic. And I actually got into a conversation with a young man this weekend, musician and actually a former bandmate of one of my sons. And we were talking about his new hobby of making sourdough bread. And he was telling me that there's been quite a boom in sourdough bread baking in recent months, especially with the coronavirus pandemic, keeping a lot of people kind of shut down in their homes. Folks looking for things to do, new hobbies, new things to get into. One of the things appears to be sourdough bread baking, resulting in, I guess, in some instances, actually shortages in ingredients. It's been tough for some people to find yeasts and flour and stuff that they need to. But I guess that is just a sign of, when you see a trend like this, sometimes that's what happens. I've got actually four people joining us this morning to talk about sourdough bread baking. We're going to talk about what is sourdough, how do you make sourdough bread. We're going to talk about the trends in popularity, et cetera, et cetera. And the list includes our friend from the Burlington area, Dan Rome, who is a young sourdough bread baker in addition to being a gigging sax player and musician in the Burlington area. So, Dan, thank you very much for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dave.
And we also have Blair Marvin. She is a baker and co-owner at Elmore Mountain Bread. So she's really in the thick of this thing as a profession, and wanted to get somebody of that perspective as well. And Blair, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Yeah, hi, Dave. Great, thank you.
Paul Markowitz has a cottage industry going in Montpelier. I believe he calls it Old World Bread, if I recall correctly. And Paul is on the phone with us as well. Good morning.
Nice to be here, Dave.
And finally, we have Martin Phillip from the source of flour, the big source of flour in Vermont, which is King Arthur Flour down in Norwich. And Martin, I understand you are a baker with King Arthur Flour. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining me as well. And so I am going to start with I think Dan, and Dan, tell me about your life. I guess it hasn't been going on too long so far, but you are fairly new to this whole thing of sourdough bread making.
Yeah, so I think I beat the boom. I got into it with my partner just a little bit before, just coincidentally. I think it was in December or November, one of our friends gifted us a starter that actually, I think she had acquired about a year before from the King Arthur factory, and she's been doing sourdough bread making with her mom for years. So all of a sudden we had this starter, and I had no idea what to do with it, and we start Googling. We go to the King Arthur website, was our resource. And, you know, we figure out how to feed it. We figure out how to start making some basic, like, no-knead bread recipes, you know, using our Dutch oven, really scouring the internet and learning. And now I've got a much better understanding of the different processes, and I love experimenting with different sourdough recipes and trying out different things and keeping our starter nice and healthy. We've managed to maintain the same starter. And we've also given it away to a few friends. And I think we probably came in around this, my theory is that we came in around this like early boom where people started getting into sourdough and handing out starters to people, because every time you feed your starter, you're left with 8 ounces of what's called discard that you can gift to a friend or use to make bread, or you could use to make a starter for another bread, or you could use to make pancakes or crumpets or any of the number of discard recipes, many of which you can find on King Arthur's website. So I think what happened was when the pandemic hit, everyone all of a sudden was being gifted these starters and able to keep them alive because they're actually at home and able to do these bread recipes that take, you know, 12 to 24 hours of passive attention and the need to be in the house. Everyone's working from home and looking for an excuse. So all of a sudden we're going to the store and we can't find any flour, and we had to pop our starter in the fridge to preserve it for, you know, a week at a time until we'd have to go to 4 different grocery stores, mask up, put our gloves on, and try to find it until we got our big, like, 20-ish pound bag at Costco. So in my experience, I've been baking about one or two loaves of bread once a week for about 6 or 7 months now. And it's been great. I really enjoy it. And I have a lot of respect for people that bake sourdough professionally, and a lot of respect for King Arthur for providing this amount of flour to the country. I'm realizing through my own research how much King Arthur is relied upon in the baking industry. So it's really cool that that's here.
That is really cool, and you know, I've always kind of marveled at the idea that we have this really such a backbone food company, and one of a long presence. Martin Phillip of King Arthur, tell us a little bit about the history here. You guys are one of Vermont's oldest companies, if not the oldest, right?
Yeah, it's one of the oldest companies actually in the country. Founded in 1790, began as primarily as an importer of ingredients. Because at that point we really didn't have much of a domestic wheat supply. And then over the years, you know, got into milling and distribution. And, you know, I would say in 2020, we are an employee-owned company, also a certified benefit corporation, which means that, you know, we place high values on our employees, the environment, and hopefully the health of our entire food system. So, and I guess we see ourselves not only as an ingredient company, but also hopefully as a source of knowledge and inspiration as well, because in addition to, you know, ingredients which are high quality and distributed nationally, we also have a super high value for small producers and, you know, small farmers, and for people like Blair Marvin, who's doing amazing work with local grains and freshly milled products. So we see ourselves just sort of happy to be part of this community.
And Blair Marvin, speaking of Blair Marvin, also a guest here on the Dave Graham Show, WDEV, and I'm wondering, your Martin mentioned local grains. I'm wondering, is that something that is a coming thing in Vermont? I'd always heard that things like wheat were hard to grow in Vermont.
Yeah. We work really closely with Vermont, several Vermont farmers here, in within a 50 to 60 mile radius of the bakery. The reason for that is several years ago, my husband Andrew and I, the other owner of the bakery, became really interested in sourcing grains more locally and being able to build a connection with our local grain farmers and to kind of dive more into the diversity and farming systems in Vermont. And so what we did is we ended up building a stone mill here up at the bakery. And as a result of that, we mill all of our flour here on site. And we buy all of our grain from organic grain farmers here here in northern Vermont, which has been a really amazing project, because to be able to learn more about the grains themselves and to kind of have our hand in that process and to be able to develop relationships with what we're doing all the way from, you know, from the field through the milling process, through the baking process, and then be able to translate that relationship and information and agricultural system here in Vermont to our customers. That's a real
top to bottom process that I'm sure your customers really appreciate too. And we are going to need to go. I just want to mention very shortly to a bottom of the hour news minute from CBS News and a couple words from our sponsors. But I guess we actually have about a minute to go. And Blair, I wanted to ask you. What about that reputation that I've heard? And maybe I'm just misled or something. I had always heard it's tough to grow wheat in Vermont. It's tough to grow some of the other grains. I guess oats grow here okay, or what do you know?
Well, it really depends on where they are in Vermont and what the soil history is what the soil is like for each individual farmer, what their crop rotation is. But I actually don't know of any farmers here in Vermont right now who are growing oats, but
that's interesting.
in past years, that certainly has been a thing, but
I guess my information's outdated. Hey, we do need to go to that bottom of the hour break. This is a fascinating conversation. I'm looking forward to continuing it on the other side of the break with Paul Markowitz, Dan Rome, Blair Marvin, and Martin Phillip, all about bread baking and especially sourdough bread baking. We'll continue that in just a couple minutes, folks. Stay with us.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back. I wanted to mention, just make a couple quick announcements here. One is that at the top of the hour, 11 o'clock this morning, as we have been doing every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in recent weeks, we have been going to a special live broadcast of news conferences with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials who are talking about the response to the coronavirus crisis and what level the governor talks about opening up the spigot for restoring economic activity in the state and so on. And he is going to be hosting another one of these news conferences today. WDEV will be broadcasting it live, so stay with us for that after the Dave Graham Show here this morning. The other thing I wanted to mention, of course, is that anytime you miss part of this two-hour talk block from 9 to 11 where I'm the host, you are more than welcome to join us at any time of day or night on the internet. Just go to our podcast, WDEVradio.com is the website. You can follow the link from that homepage to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit, you'll find a list of our recent programs by topic or guest, and get some clues about what you're looking for, and listen to your heart's content. Can't call us at 2 or 3 in the morning, but you can certainly listen if you're up at that hour and looking for something to do. So there you go. Anyway, I wanted to get back to our conversation about sourdough bread making, and we have a quite a cast here to help us understand all the ins and outs here. Among them, I'll list all four. How's that? Martin Phillip with Green Mountain. With King Arthur. I knew I was going to do that. I was saying that earlier, and I said, no, it's King Arthur. It's not Green Mountain. King Arthur Flour, and they've been around probably longer than any Green Mountain almost. 1790, I think you said, Martin, is that right?
That's correct.
Wow, that's pretty impressive, really. Just that longevity is something else. We also have with us Blair Marvin of Elmore Mountain Bread. They make delicious breads. I have sampled their products from time to time, and wow. Paul Markowitz, another really skilled bread maker right here based in Montpelier. He's got a little cottage industry right out of his home and has developed quite a following in our area here. And we also have with us Dan Rome, who is kind of got me into this topic. He's a friend who was talking to us over the weekend about his new bread baking hobby, only of about 7 months or 6 or 7 months or something like that. But he is a real enthusiast and has studied up on this stuff. So I thought even at the tender age of his bread baking career, he seemed to have a lot of information. Hey, Dan, you were mentioning in our conversation over the weekend, and actually earlier on in this conversation this morning, the sort of care and feeding of your starter. And for people who aren't familiar with how all this works, is this something you like keep out in your doghouse and have to feed every day, or no? I shouldn't be. Yeah. But what is this starter that you're feeding and you're caring for in between your baking projects?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of sour fermented dough. I have about 12 ounces of it at a time. And if it's out on the counter at about 70 degrees Fahrenheit, we feed ours, which is it's like a derivative of the King Arthur flour starter from their factory. So I feed it every 12 hours, so usually around 11 a.m. and 11 p.m. And you take 4 ounces of the starter, which is full of the wild yeast and the lactobacillus bacteria, and that's what makes sourdough taste like sourdough. And you feed it 4 ounces of water. I use filtered water from my Brita, and 4 ounces of King Arthur all-purpose flour. You can feed it other kinds of flour, like if you're prepping for a rye bread, you can actually make a derivative of your starter that's just like you can separate one off just to make that bit of bread, and that's called a levain or a poulish, depending on how wet it is, and or a sponge, or there's all sorts of names for it. And you can feed it a little bit of rye, or you can feed it a little bit of bread flour. But yeah, we feed it every 12 hours. My partner's actually feeding ours right now. I can hear it in the other room. We weigh it out, one part starter, one part all-purpose unbleached flour, and one part filtered water. And then it eats that, and it rises about 3 times in height. It gets all nice and bubbly, and you can smell the, you know, it smells like sourdough. And then you can use that active starter to make bread or any number of other sourdough products. And that yeast that's in sourdough starter is why you don't have to use instant yeast or active dry yeast in a lot of sourdough bread recipes. And that's also why they take a little bit longer to the bulk fermentation, the long fermentation period and of sourdough bread. It's a little bit longer than if you use wild yeast or if you use regular yeast, because it takes a little bit longer to stand that bread.
I see. Huh. Blair Marvin of Elmore Mountain Bread, you just heard a kind of a bread making rookie expound on his method with dealing with his starter. Sound like he's doing it right?
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of different bakers, and the way you maintain your sourdough is very individual to the baker's schedule, whether you're a home baker or a commercial baker, and really it depends on how often you bake the bread as well. So for us, we bake between 500 and 600 loaves twice a week, and we keep a liquid levain, which is similar to what he was talking about, which is equal parts flour and water, and we feed ours twice a day and keep it very healthy and active because of our regular baking schedule. But our levain is probably 17 years old now. And we've kind of been mature, you know, refreshing it is the term for feeding it every day, refreshing it and discarding the leftover starter and kind of keeping it going all those years. So.
How long can they last?
how long can your starter last? Well, it really depends on the activity level. And so what you want to do is to feed it, because as the starter digests the food, which is the flour, that kind of gives it its activity level, and it can and keep its vigor for whenever you're ready to start baking with it.
Now, I was kind of joking about the doghouse and all that, but I mean, usually when I think of feeding something, we do have a couple dogs in the house, and you know, we obviously, like most people do, we have names for them. Do you have a name for your starter?
Actually, we do not.
Okay.
Most bakers I know do, though. It's pretty interesting,
really?
To always find out what they name their starters.
Paul Markowitz, what's the name of your starter?
That's funny. I can tell you the starter's 40 years old, but it doesn't have a name yet.
Wow. Huh, okay. So I guess there are some anonymous starters out there as well, but that is sort of, it's a kind of a cool idea. I don't know if I'm going to start a new fad here of bread bakers naming their starters, but and Paul, you're based here in Montpelier, and I think you mentioned here that and maybe others are doing this as well, but you are happy to give away your starter and your recipe. Is that right?
That's right. My motto is kind of spread bread. And about a year ago, when I stopped working full time and, you know, casting about, what should I do? And I was focusing on my passions, and I've been baking sourdough bread for 40 years, a starter that was started in Hinesburg, Vermont, 40 years ago. And,
wow.
And so I'm, you know, I bake, we're talking really small, out of my house in Dutch ovens, cast iron Dutch ovens. You know, I bake anywhere between 15 and 25 loaves a week. And I'm happy to give away my starter and my recipe. I think it's really important for folks to understand that there's no one way to make sourdough bread. And, you know, you find a recipe and you find other recipes and you talk with people and you come up with kind of a process that really works for you, and the taste, the texture, you know, the crumb, the crust, all that you know, that you're looking for. So.
And Martin Phillip of King Arthur Flour, I'm wondering, if you have a sense of the market out there, how many sourdough bread bakers would you suspect there are in Vermont, and are there more per capita here than in other parts of the country?
I have this hunch that we are in the fortunate position of having more serious home bakers per capita than probably any state in the country. I think that it probably follows other trends which relate to things like community-supported agriculture, craft breweries, farmers markets. These are people who have value for the proximity to the source of their food, and I think that what closer way can you make something that you eat that's produced from your own hands? I can't think of another example that's closer than bread, which has that connection to your very hands. So I think there are a lot of serious home bakers in Vermont, and I think that we're also in this situation where we have such an abundance of riches in terms of small bakeries like Elmore and like Red Hen and Middlesex, and like Paul's Bakery in Montpelier, or O'Bread, or King Arthur, or many other places. We as Vermonters have a high value for good bread. And so I think it's a good place to be. And we have...
I got to say, I'm amazed sometimes. I have family from, living in other parts of the country, some of them in major metropolitan areas, and they come up here. Don't forget La Panchada, by the way. That's one of our faves. But, I mean, there are tons of them. And they come up here, and we go over to the co-op. Of course, they come up here before the pandemic prevented a lot of this kind of travel. But anyway, we'd go over to the Hunger Mountain Co-op here in Montpelier, and they would just, their jaws would drop at the variety and the quality and the excellence of, like a half a dozen or more different bread makers who have their wares on for sale at the co-op. We'll pick up a loaf of this and a loaf of that and just go home, and over the 3-day weekend or whatever their visit is, we'll sample some of each. And it's kind of an amazing an amazing mecca for great bread, isn't it? Martin, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting to me is why. You know, why in Vermont are we so? Why do we have the food values that we have, and how can we talk to everybody else and get them on board? Because I think that the future health and also safety, the nutritional value, so many aspects of what we eat relate to where we eat. And I like the idea of eating in place, and I think that includes supporting our local brewers and our bakers and our people growing vegetables and farming and everything. So I think it's part of our culture. It's one of the things that I'm most proud of as a Vermonter. So I think we ought to try to export it to the greatest degree possible.
Hey, Dave.
I also think that goes back to your question earlier, Dave, too, about grains in Vermont. You know, Vermont and New England really used to be a grain hub and a breadbasket, and then because of space and growing climates out in the West, it migrated to the West. But now, as people are seeing that value, as you're saying, Martin, with the food that is grown and having a connection with the food, knowing where their food is and understanding the story and sourcing locally and really looking to that now in our modern climate and with the way that people are eating, that's why grains is making this amazing comeback for and becoming available for us bread bakers and consumers here in Vermont, because people's habits are changing and the values that they're placing in that connection with the food and understanding the stories of it, and also ways to support our farmers, whether they're grain farmers or meat farmers or dairy farmers. It's a really nice way and practical way to kind of bring diversity back to our farming systems, and that's so important here in Vermont, and it gives an opportunity for our farmers and our consumers to do that and excite people at the same time. So,
Paul, I think you were going to have get a word in. What's on your mind now?
Well, I was going to, Central Vermont, even compared to Burlington, for example, the range of amazing sourdough bread that we have here, I think it's more than coincidence that it's in Central Vermont, and I think it's really important to give tribute to Jules and Helen Raven, who baked the, out of a wood-fired oven over
in Plainfield.
Plainfield, Marshfield area, and
yeah.
The most amazing bread, and I just think they're an inspiration for me, and I think for a lot of people, and I think people are like, hey, where can I get more of this amazing bread? And of course, they're not baking anymore, but I don't know. That's just my sense, that it's got to be more than coincidence that they were out here 25, 30 years, I don't even know how long ago, baking amazing bread. So tribute to those guys and inspiration for bringing some of that old world, old style sourdough bread to Central Vermont.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Paul. I'm glad you mentioned the Ravens, because clearly they were sort of this, the grandparents of a lot of this bread baking movement. Interesting too that there seems to be this organic connection between it's kind of the home bread makers and then people who get excited enough about it to try to go into business like yourself, Paul. I mean, I see this, the same thing is in seems to be a habit among brewers, in Vermont, and so we have this burgeoning, of course, really world class beer and craft beer industry now, and I'm still at the small end of it. I'm a home brewer myself, so I mess around with the yeast a little bit, and I think I was saying to somebody the other day, it's kind of like the liquid form of sourdough bread making sometimes, but it's the same kind of connection between, and people have said to me, gee, Dave, your beer is really good. Maybe you should go into, open up a small brewery. And I always have to explain to them that well, Vermont actually has plenty, plenty of beer. I don't think it would be a tough market to break into at this point. And also just, I think I have a sneaking suspicion we really need more than we do beer brewers right now. So that's just maybe my bias showing up there. But anyway, I wanted to ask Paul, since you are on this kind of recently through the portal from a home hobbyist to a bread entrepreneur, How's that transition been for you?
I could say I've learned more about bread making in the last year than I have in the previous 39. And
wow.
Part of it is that, you know, when you want to make a product that is consistent each week because you want your customers to say, oh, yeah, that's what I'm getting, you know, you have to do things like weigh your quantity. You have to measure. You have to control the temperature. You have to watch the duration. I mean, you know, when you're a home baker, it's, it wasn't perfect, but you're going to eat it. So that's been, and if nothing else out of this whole process, I have a better bread than I did a year ago. And I just, you know, the thing about getting into it was like, I felt like, you know, if I was making the same bread that was already out there, I wouldn't do it. Mine's a little bit, it's a unique bread. It's a little bit different. It's not for everyone. The people who love it, you know, love it. They come to my house. They pick it up on Thursdays. And I think there's also that aspect of the local aspect of people. This like, I know where my food comes from. I know where my bread comes from. I know where my beer comes from.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really big appeal there, especially during this coronavirus. People are like, I don't have to go to the store. I can just go over to the porch and pick it up, and and I know it's baked and it's right around the corner. And I think that's a strong appeal to some people.
Yeah, for sure. Blair Marvin from Elmore Mountain Bread. Did you start out as a home baker and then expand into a business, or how did that work for you?
Actually, prior to Elmore Mountain Bread, I had very, very little experience bread baking and was definitely not a home bread baker. I went to culinary school, and I grew up here in Vermont, but moved away. So many do, but moved back here and was working in a local cafe. This was like 17 years ago, and I was buying baguettes from this really, really teeny tiny little wood-fired bakery up in Elmore. And the guy I was buying the baguettes from one day said, he walked into the kitchen and said, "Hey, do you know anybody that wants to buy a house, 10 acres, and a wood-fired bakery?" I was like, "Oh, geez, no, I don't. I'll put the word out there, but boy, I'd love to come see it." And sure enough, my husband and I, or my now husband and I, came up just for a visit. And we're just overwhelmed. We're like, we don't know why, but this is what we want to do. And so, you know, I was in my early 20s, and before I knew it, we suddenly were the owners of this small wood-fired bakery and a new home. And we had Jeffrey Hamelman's bread book and each other, and we basically put our heads down and just taught each other how to bake. We both had culinary backgrounds, so we had that sense. And education behind us, but really it was through trial and error and connecting with other bakers and reading and years of making really awful bread. and it's just kind of progressed from there.
Got to have a few bad batches early on in your career, right?
Yeah.
At least that was my case in brewing, that's for sure.
Yeah, especially with wood-fired baking, it was a difficult learning curve, but it's extremely rewarding. So
after a while, when you get it down, it does become really, really nice. So, Dan Rome, I'm wondering, how would you describe your bread? I mean, you have a recipe. What type of bread is it?
That's a good question. I think to touch on the topic of the local bread thing, I think with sourdough, for me, I make two loaves at a time. I use theperfectloaf.com is my favorite website for. His name is Maurizio, and he just has these really beautiful loaves and really elaborate processes. He talks about the gear that he uses. So if you want to get into, you know, if you want to know what kind of flour you should look into or alternative, you can really get a lot of information on that. So I've been trying out different loaves from his website. I have one called the weekday. Sourdough bread. It's like a simpler recipe, and I make two loaves and I give one to my dad. And the biggest thing with sourdough is that it really doesn't like last that long. So you know, you get it out of the oven and it's best that day, 2 hours after it's cooled, because it kind of cooks for another hour or two while it's cooling. And so I think that part of the localness of it is that you really have to, for a good like home cooked sourdough bread, you need to get it locally. So it's chewier than when you go to the store, it's got this really intense crust to it. And it's just, I've been experimenting with different whole wheat and rye varieties, and it just has this like really wholesome, delicious, like flavorful meal like texture. It's just different than regular like white bread or kind of sandwich bread you get at the store, which is more of like a cake. Sourdough bread is definitely has a lot more texture and density to it, which is what I like about it.
Yeah.
And you're always
I want to squeeze in a listener here, a caller on the line, Forbes from East Corinth. Good morning, Forbes.
Hi, how are you? Got a question
doing well. I'm sorry?
I had a question for your brewer.
Okay.
My son's a brewmaster, and I've argued this point many times with him. 16-ounce versus 12-ounce, the standard of the industry seems to be 16-ounce. That's a lot of beer for some people. He said that that's something that the industry has just adopted, and you don't see many 12-ounce. Is there anything on that?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure why the commercial beer industry has gone to the bigger containers. I'm really not at all involved in that part of the realm. And for myself, I happen to have a collection of the old style of swing top bottles, the ones where you push it with your thumbs on the sort of two metal rods and the gasket cap pops off, and those are half liter, just about 16 ounces. But I find myself a lot of times just having half of one, recapping it, putting it back in the fridge. It's perfectly fine. It hasn't gone flat or anything the next day, and that's so that's one approach if you're trying to limit your intake, I guess. Anyway, thanks for the call, Forbes. Appreciate it. We are fast approaching the top of the hour. I'd love to talk about sourdough bread for another hour, but I've got to let my four guests go here. Blair Marvin from the Elmore Mountain Bread, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Dan Rome, a young bread maker from up in the Burlington area, also a musician. We have been speaking with Martin Phillip from Green Mountain. I'm going to get this right eventually. From King Arthur Flour. On the other side of the Green Mountains down there in Norwich, King Arthur Flour. And we also have been speaking with Paul Markowitz. The four of you have been terrific. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty.
Good one.
Bye. All right, you too. Hey, and that's about it for the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. Stay tuned now for Governor Phil Scott's news conference on the coronavirus response. Have a good day, everybody.